our headlines, the Israeli military says it has launched airstrikes against areas in Lebanon hours after it shelled parts of the country. More high-ranking foreign officials arrive in Tehran to attend the swearing-in ceremony of Iran's new president, Ebrahim Raisi, on Thursday. Also, the U.S. rejects the U.N. Health Agency's call for a halt to COVID-19 vaccine boosters as the gap between vaccinations in wealthy and poor countries widens. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Israeli warplanes carry out airstrikes in Lebanon south hours after the regime shelled the country. The Israeli military claimed that the attack was in response to earlier rocket fire from the area. The regime had earlier shelled areas in southern Lebanon three times. Israel accused armed Palestinian groups inside Lebanon of launching the rockets, but no group has yet claimed responsibility. There has also been no report of any casualties or damage. Over the past years, the Israeli military has repeatedly shelled areas within Lebanon and violated the country's airspace, prompting fierce criticism from Beirut. Iran's ambassador to the UK has condemned and rejected as fabricated claims that say the Islamic Republic is undermining maritime security in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman. In a letter to the Secretary General of the International Maritime Organization based in London, Mohsen Baharvand also urged the international community to collaborate to counter such destabilizing remarks. Meanwhile, the Deputy Permanent Representative of Iran to the UN said the UK, Romania, and Liberia have, without providing any evidence, alleged the Islamic Republic has attacked a vessel off the coast of Oman. In a letter to the UN Security Council, Zahra Ershadi also warned of suspicious attempts to create false flag maritime incidents and called for an end to such practices. High-ranking foreign officials and dignitaries are arriving in Tehran to attend the swearing-in ceremony of Iran's new president, Ebrahim Raisi. The Venezuelan vice president, as well as other officials from countries including South Korea, Malaysia, Italy, Oman, and Syria, have arrived at the Iranian capital for the ceremony. This as senior EU envoys led by European External Action Service Deputy Secretary General Enrique Mora had already entered Tehran. 10 heads of state, 20 parliament speakers, and over 20 ministers will take part in the ceremony on Thursday. Delegates from international and regional organizations including OPEC and the Economic Cooperation Organization will also attend the venue. Raisi's swearing-in will be held 2 days after leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, officially endorsed him as Iran's eighth president in a ceremony in Tehran.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has officially endorsed Ebrahim Raisi as the country's new president, who won over 60% of the votes in the June presidential election. In a speech during the ceremony, the leader urged Raisi to rely on domestic capabilities to tackle existing problems. Raisi, who will be inaugurated later this week, takes office at a time the country is grappling with serious economic problems. The government of outgoing President Hassan Rouhani blamed the votes on U.S. sanctions, which were reimposed in 2018. Washington's measure were part of a so-called maximum pressure campaign following its unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Since April 2021, Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have held 6 rounds of talks in Vienna with the aim of reviving the accord under the new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden. But the talks seem to have reached an impasse due to what Tehran sees as excessive demands by Washington and its Western allies. Iran began reducing its JCPOA commitments 1 year after the U.S. withdrawal and in reaction to the failure of the remaining parties to secure its interests under the deal. Tehran has already made it clear that the deal cannot be revived unless Washington removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner and gives assurances that it will not abandon the deal again. Ironically, the U.S. and its Western allies are trying to deviate from the original agreement. They are now insisting that the talks on the JCPOA revival must include Iran's regional influence and its missile program, a demand that the Islamic Republic has rejected. During his endorsement ceremony, Raisi touched upon the policies government would pursue to deal with the sanctions.
We will certainly pursue the removal of cruel sanctions, but we will definitely not allow the people's livelihoods and the economy to be impacted by it. And we will not link the removal of sanctions to the will of foreigners.
Top officials in the Biden administration, including the Secretary of State, have already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign of the Trump administration, which was aimed at pushing Iran to renegotiate the JCPOA and give in to U.S. demands, has failed. Now, with a new president in Iran who has briefly highlighted his policy in dealing with the U.S. sanctions, it remains to be seen if the United States changes its course or continues to press ahead with its failed pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic.
The United Nations has expressed concern about the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan's southern city of Lashkargah, where heavy clashes are ongoing between government forces and the Taliban.
Tens of thousands of people could be trapped by the fighting. Our humanitarian colleagues also tell us that in Helmand and Kandahar, there are reported increased civilian casualties, destruction or damage to civilian houses, as well as to critical infrastructure, including hospitals.
The UN spokesman added that medical centers and health workers are becoming overwhelmed by the number of wounded people. At least 40 civilians have been killed during the battle for Lashkargah, the capital of the Helmand province. Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks across Afghanistan since May, seizing large swaths of rural and urban areas, including some key border crossings. They are now focused on capturing provincial capitals. The Taliban have also vowed to ramp up assaults against top government officials. COVID-19 infections worldwide have passed the shocking figure of 200 million as the more infectious Delta variant drives up cases. The pandemic has also left over 4.2 million people dead since it started. It took over a year for COVID-19 cases to hit the 100 million mark, while the next 100 million were reported in just over 6 months. The United States is the worst country hit by the outbreak so far, with deaths nearing 615,000. Brazil has the second deadliest outbreak with almost 560,000 fatalities. The Latin American country has also reported over 20 million cases. Official figures show at least 2.6% of the world's population have been infected, but the true figure is likely higher due to limited testing in many places. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is calling for a halt to COVID-19 vaccine boosters as the gap between vaccinations in wealthy and poor countries widens. Let's take a listen.
We need an urgent reversal from the majority of vaccines going to high-income countries to the majority going to low-income countries. Accordingly, WHO is calling for a moratorium on boosters until at least the end of September to enable at least 10% of the population of every country to be vaccinated.
Tedros urged the countries and companies controlling the supply of doses to change course immediately and prioritize less wealthy states. He said it is unacceptable for countries that have already used most of the global supply to use even more of it. The United States rejected the WHO appeal, calling it a false choice.
We believe we can do both. We also, in this country, have enough supply to ensure that every American has access to a vaccine. We will have enough supply to ensure if the FDA decides that boosters are recommended for a portion of the population to provide those as well. We believe we can do both, and we don't need to make that choice.
Psaki said the United States has donated millions of vaccines and would continue to do so. The WHO has for months been sounding the alarm over a glaring and growing imbalance in vaccine availability against COVID-19 that has killed over 4 million people worldwide. Figures show in high-income countries, 101 doses per 100 people have been injected. In contrast, low-income countries have only been able to administer nearly 2 doses for every 100 people due to lack of supply. Mexico has filed a lawsuit against several American gun makers in a U.S. federal court, accusing them of reckless business practices that supplied illegal arms to violent Mexican drug cartels. Earlier, we discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's see what our guests have to say. Hello, and welcome to another edition of News Review. Thank you for joining us. Mexico has sued several U.S. gun makers in a federal court, accusing them of reckless business practices that supplied illegal arms to violent Mexican drug cartels. The lawsuit was filed in the U.S. District Court of Massachusetts. It alleges that the American companies knew their businesses, or business practices, I should say, had encouraged what it called a, quote, torrent of illegal arms trafficking into Mexico, leading to thousands of deaths. Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard said the objective of the lawsuit is that the companies in question compensate Mexico's government for the damages caused by their negligent operations. Mexican officials said the lawsuit sought an estimated $10 billion. They said the weapons trafficked to Mexico were responsible for at least 17,000 murders during 2019 alone. Joining me to discuss this issue further is Jose Carreno Figueres. He is a foreign affairs columnist for El Heraldo de Mexico, joining us out of Mexico City. And also Nick Ayala. He is an editor for Anticonquista, joining us out of Newark, New Jersey. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining the program. So I want to start off with our guest in Mexico City. Mexico alleges that gun makers are fully unnoticed of massive trafficking of their guns into Mexico, but haven't implemented any measures to control the flow of weapons. If true, what does that say about the situation that Mexico is dealing with right now?
Well, the point is difficult. Number one, while it is true, absolutely true, that the contraband, that the traffic of weaponry between the U.S. and Mexico is almost unabated, almost non-stop. The problem is also that we have some of the most violent crime organizations in the world. So it is, as we say in Mexico, the hunger and the wish to eat are getting together. So we are having now about 20,000 deaths this year so far. We have a problem where some people claim that the Mexican government, in this case, is unable to stop that violence. And the fact also that, again, the weapons trafficking from the U.S. to Mexico is nonstop. So it is a very difficult situation. And it is very much also a question of domestic politics, both in Mexico and the U.S. That makes it more difficult.
Nick, reportedly and allegedly, these guns are falling into the hands of drug cartels and criminals in Mexico. Well, obviously, gun manufacturers are benefiting from this, maximizing their profits. But some think the game is much bigger than this. Some say that the U.S. has a share in the profits made by the drug cartels. Do you see any truth in that? And if so, what are the implications?
Well, the reality is that the black market trade in gun exports makes up about $127 million for gun dealers and the corporations in particular in the United States. So to say that doesn't have some sort of share or some sort of interest that the U.S. gun manufacturers have in this black market trade, I think is foolish. They clearly have an investment in this trade. Without the selling of weapons not only to Mexico but also dumping weapons in places like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan into war zones, and Mexico, given the intense violence that many of the cartels and the criminal underground runs, can be considered in some parts a war zone. This is a major profit opportunity for many of the gun manufacturers and gun corporations here in the United States. And that's, you know, you can't separate that profit motive and the desire to drive up profits for these corporations from their desire to also put weapons into whatever community they can find that will be able to get them more money. So I think there is a connection, and a very clear connection between the two. The U.S. corporations have, at the same time, or the U.S., I should say, as a nation as a whole, has become the number one exporter of weapons across the globe. More than one-third of all weapons bought or imported from other countries are coming from the United States. So there's a clear profit incentive, and there's a clear connection between the profits for these gun corporations and this black market trade.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. Mr. Figueres, do you want to comment on that?
Look, I mostly agree with that point, with those points. I should say, though, that if you consider that the U.S. The market in the United States for that kind of arms, this kind of arms, it was last year about $9 billion, and that the export market, as he says, is an important market as a general. The black market, I do not know, because most of the weaponry arrives in small batches. So, and this is sold in small armories or fairs or things like that. I don't know. I do not disagree, but basically, I must say that a lot of this is basically small in small pieces. Now, having said that, I think that the most benefited are the weapons merchants in the South and the Southwest. So, and they are really selling without any checking, without any problem.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for coming on the program and sharing your thoughts with us. I've been talking to Jose Carreno Figueres. He is a foreign affairs columnist for El Heraldo de Mexico, joining us out of Mexico City. And Nick Ayla, he's an editor for Anticonquista, joining us out of Newark. Well, that does it for this edition of World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Seven new large fires were reported on Sunday, August 2nd, bringing the total number of wildfires raging in the United States to 91, according to the National Interagency Fire Center, NIFC. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Amir Vira and Dina Hackney, reporters. This article is published under the heading, 91 wildfires are burning across U.S., with Oregon's Bootleg Fire growing to over 400,000 acres. Stay tuned for more. Seven new large fires were reported on Sunday, August 2nd, bringing the total number of wildfires raging in the United States to 91, according to the National Interagency Fire Center, NIFC. More than 1.8 million acres have burned since these fires began, the NIFC said. More than 22,300 wildland firefighters and incident management teams are involved in battling the blazes. This year, 37,803 fires have burned more than 3 million acres across the United States, per NIFC. During the same period in 2020, 32,059 fires burned a total of 2.1 million acres. As hot temperatures and very dry vegetation persist, it is important to stay informed on current and predicted environmental conditions, NIFC said in its Sunday, August 2nd update. Check for fire restrictions and closures before you head out to enjoy your public lands. Now more than ever, we need your help to prevent wildfires, they said. Idaho is the state with the biggest number of large fires at 23. However, Oregon has the most acres burned, 554,587 among its 11 fires. The Bootleg Fire near the California border is alone responsible for burning 413,734 acres. The Bootleg Fire is currently at 74% containment and isn't expected to be fully contained until October 1st, according to NCWEB, the conglomerate for fire information in the U.S. The Dixie Fire in California has reached 244,888 acres in size and is 32% contained, according to the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. A total of 67 structures have been destroyed due to the Dixie Fire, and an evacuation order remains in place for the Boot Meadows, Jonesville, and Lake Philbrook areas. There have been no fatalities reported at this time. The Tamarack Fire, which is burning south of Lake Tahoe, is now 84% contained, according to NCWEB. It began on July 4th due to a lightning strike, and most evacuation orders for the area have now been lifted. Wildfires aren't just affecting the mainland U.S. The Mauna Road Fire on northern side of Hawaii's Big Island led to the evacuation of more than 7,000 people, according to County of Hawaii's Communications Director Cyrus Johnson. The fire has scorched more than 40,000 acres since it started recently. So far, two homes have been destroyed, Johnson told CNN by phone. Monsoon season has arrived in the west, bringing with it mudslides, flash flooding, and dust storms. The monsoon moisture moving into the region could potentially stomp out some fires and quench the dry vegetation and soil, but it could also cause more dangerous conditions. Lightning and high fire danger will likely result in new fire starts. Gusty thunderstorm winds could contribute to fire spread. Despite rainfall, initial attack resources could be overwhelmed and holdover fires are possible, said the National Weather Service office in Medford, Oregon. Red flag warnings are in place across central and eastern Oregon for the weekend, where the potential for thunderstorms has drawn out worries for more fire starts. With the Bootleg fire already blistering over 400,000 acres of the Oregon hills, lightning and strong winds from monsoon thunderstorms could start more fires, further straining resources. The rainfall might help control some fires in the region, but left behind will be the scorched earth that is prone to runoff and flash flooding. The United States isn't the only country experiencing serious wildfires. For the second straight day, more than 1,100 people have been evacuated by sea from the tourist hotspot of Bodrum to escape Turkey's forest fires burning along the Mediterranean coast. We help the evacuation of 1,140 people by 12 boats. Oran Dine, president of Bodrum Maritime Chamber, told CNN on August 2nd, "We did evacuation by boats yesterday as well, but I never witnessed something similar before in this region. This is the first time," a witness said. Then said, "While roads remain open and evacuations continue by land, evacuations by sea help keep roads open for fire trucks and ambulances." The death toll in Turkey's forest fires along the Mediterranean coast has increased to at least 8 people killed on Sunday, August 2nd, according to state-run Anadolu agency. The latest victims include a Turkish-German couple who were found in a house. According to the Turkish Agriculture and Forestry Ministry, 111 fires have started across the country since July 28. 6 fires are still burning in 3 different cities, the ministry said.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady here from IRIB English Radio. Inshallah ta'ala, we are going to be having a series of discussions regarding the topic of women of Ashura, or Ashura and women. In the studio, as always, I have the pleasure and honor of having my lovely sister and friend and wonderful guest, Sister Razia Shamli. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear sister. I love the way you labeled Ashura in women.
Because, you know, Ashura, you women, it's like, it's restricting, I feel. But when we look at Ashura within ourselves, then it gives it longevity. If I feel like it lives on. Right? So this is a very important discussion to have, because often I feel that when we look about the when we look at the events of Ashura and the tragedies that took place in the plain of Karbala, it's like, oh, it happened 1,400 years ago to a handful of really extraordinary people, and how could that ever happen again, and how am I supposed to relate to that, you know? And we could never put ourselves in the place of Sayyida Zainab, because no one could carry on what she did. We would collapse and fall. We would be dysfunctional in those circumstances.
But what would you say of Lady Maryam? What would you say of Lady Asiya? What would you say of Lady Fatima? What would you say of Lady Khadija? All these women were extraordinary.
Exactly, they were.
And each of them were in their own, you know, cases.
Most of them were borderline infallible. I mean, even when I think about Lady Maryam, she was very young when she was blessed with Prophet Isa, ala nabina wa alihi alayhi salam. But even, it's not possible to replicate Maryam in today's world. You want a girl to live in a temple or a mosque or a room in her house?
You have these monks, you have these sisters living in temples, and they dedicate their entire life.
Yeah, but
their
when
youth,
they're adults
beauty.
And do it, it's okay, because they chose it themselves. But to raise a child from the get-go in a monastery, in a temple, in a masjid, and deprive them of all the childhood experiences, playing and talking and making
a mess, around.
Yeah, barefoot in the grass.
You never know, you know? These pages of history are dark to us.
They very much
us,
are.
And we don't know anything about
exactly.
them. Perhaps, these were like complexes. It wasn't like one single room, you know, that kids wouldn't, actually kids at that time, they weren't like kids in our time. Their dolls were like one piece of stick of wood. And
eyes carved in them.
Exactly. So their childhood at that time, centuries ago, were
simplistic.
Not even comparable to what we do for our children, you know.
True.
We buy sets of toys, clothes, furniture for our children that they don't even use them.
Yeah, exactly.
And we spoil them. And the outcome of our child raising is not so fruitful in our time. So it's not like what we're doing is the best and what they did was catastrophic. So I think that probably Lady Maryam, when she was 2, 3, 4, 5, she ran around, she had her own playtime. You know, she had her own childish games going on.
But I do think that they were all exceptions of history. Now, no one like Maryam is ever going to happen again. No one like Fatima al-Zahra. No one like Zainab al-Kubra. No one. Come on. Be honest. Can you imagine any woman, any other, even Sayyidah Fatima, sallallahu alayha, she said after her father's demise, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that if the calamities that befell me during this time befell upon the day, it would turn into night. She was an exception.
Yeah, but still you can find so many people. You know, when you are placed in the heart of a challenging situation, God gives you the power. Of course, maybe not exactly. You wouldn't turn out like, say, the Fatima salamullah alayha, but you have extraordinary powers reserved within you. A human being has the potential, has the capability. Seriously, I believe in this. These days, all these positive thinking ladies who are going on Instagram, they're just giving you positive vibes every single morning and telling you that the impossible can be made possible if you believe and if you work towards it. Yeah? So this is just with the materialistic approach, they're, you know, trying to prove what they're saying is right. But in the spiritual realm, the same story holds valid. And I really think that the spirit of human being has the potential to reach its full capacity if there's a will.
Exactly. Which basically means that we all have this potential, our souls, our nafs, whether to do good or do bad. But we're going to go on a short break and we're going to be right back, so don't go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady here on IRB English Radio. We're here in the studio with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're discussing Ashura'i women and Ashura'in women. We were talking about, in brief, some women in history that I personally think are just exceptions of humanity. But, you know, that's the job of our show. We take exceptions, we take
rare cases,
and exactly try to dissect them and find certain factors in them that we can apply to our own lives. Exactly. And we're going to try to focus our attention on the movement of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam and how it was preserved and continued by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And how we can...
A woman or women?
Women led by a woman, you know? And Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam also being protected by a woman. You know, Sayyidah Zainab, she just played a very, like, hardcore, heroine, awesome role.
I know, at the end of the day, you, like, the only lady that you can find so much to talk about is Lady Zainab.
I know.
But also, before delving into the heart of history and talking about these ladies, I kept thinking about one specific lady today, which... is in our own time, not so long ago.
Interesting.
She was martyred. Mm-hmm. She was born in Iraq, I think in the city of Qadamain, and born in a very noble family, a scholarly family. Her brother was also a martyr.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right.
I think you can guess
I can
what
guess
her
now.
Name is.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Bintul Huda,
exactly.
As-Sadr.
Exactly.
I think her given name was Amina, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And she was a remarkable woman.
Yeah.
She was an author as well.
Exactly.
She was a writer.
Exactly.
She'd write short stories for women.
Exactly.
I think I've read a few of her books. She has a very somber, very mellow, warm sort of pen.
Mm.
And she was brave. She was brave. Like with a capital B.
So she's an exceptional woman as well. One of those exceptional women that we cannot really compare ourselves with.
Yes and no.
Why yes and no?
Yes, in the sense that she was a sadr. She was born and weaned and raised in a scholarly family, like
of
you said.
As-Sadr.
Of the sadrs. Right? I'm not saying all the sadrs are like
awesome
exceptional
people.
Awesome people. But still, come on. Nurture is a factor, upbringing, nurture,
there
family
so
environment.
There are so many innumerable factors, but you have to take a holistic approach when you're talking about a human being. I was just, things come in between. I was also reading about this other lady and her story in supporting the ambassador of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about...
her name was...
Tawa.
Right?
So Tawa was a lady in the city of Kufa, and she was the wife of Usayd Khazrami and the mother of a dude called Bilal. And then Muslim ibn Aqil was in Kufa. It was nighttime, nightfall. Everybody had rejected him. In the morning, hundreds of people were behind supporting him and telling him, yeah, we're with Imam Hussein. They had actually sent letters to Imam Hussein.
And they pledged their allegiance.
They pledged allegiance. And by nightfall, they all
revolted against him.
They just changed their mind and
they were paid off.
They just left.
Yep.
And he was all alone in the alleys of the city of Kufa. And the only person who came and, you know, took him to her house was this lady, Tawa.
Mm.
And her son was this Bilal who reported them to the forces of Ibn Ziyad, and then the lady and Muslim ibn Aqil were both martyred on the 8th of Zilhijjah. You were talking about being raised in a noble family. You see, of course, there is a very strong relationship between by whom you are raised up,
for sure,
and whose blood
runs in your veins.
But this is not the only story.
Absolutely.
This lady, Tawa, was the mother of Bilal, who reported them to Ibn Ziyad. Mm. So, as you know, you're saying, yeah, these are the Sadr family, you know, and they're exceptional, and it's like, it makes it a little harder for you if you are raised in a non-godly family.
Exactly,
but it's not,
that's what I meant. That's what I meant by yes and no. On one hand, she already had the groundwork. On the other hand, well, obviously, she had her potential. She could have, you know, had different inclinations, but she didn't. We have so many freedom fighters and brave figures and personalities, say, in Palestine, from mm-hmm. totally normal families, mm-hmm. but they fight for justice, they fight against oppression, they fight for their people, their brave men and women.
Or that Italian rich guy, millionaire, who was martyred, who became Shia.
Eduardo
Agnelli. Mm. You see, he was the son of Ford company.
Owner.
And then he became to be a true Shiite, and, you know, the story about him.
Exactly. So the point is that there are a lot of components at play, like you said, and it doesn't necessarily depend on one single factor. But in any case, the objective of our show, the series of show we're going to have on this topic, is to try to apply all these factors into our lives and see how we can work about it and navigate toward the direction of getting close to those standards we set up for ourselves, i.e. those exceptional women in history, right? Because if you want to set standards for yourself, obviously the standard has to be higher than you.
Mm.
That's all the time we have for today's episode. Thank you for being with us. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
With a number of migrants crossing the southern border surging and the pandemic proving to be far from over, the Biden administration has decided to leave in place for now the public health rule that has allowed it to turn away hundreds of thousands of migrants, officials confirmed. Citing new concerns about the spread of the coronavirus, the Biden administration will continue to roll out for now on a Trump-era policy. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Eileen Sullivan, Zolan Kano-Young, and Miriam Jordan. The piece is titled, Biden Administration to Keep Using Public Health Rule to Turn Away Migrants. Number of migrants crossing the southern border surging and the pandemic proving to be far from over, the Biden administration has decided to leave in place for now the public health rule that has allowed it to turn away hundreds of thousands of migrants, officials confirmed. The decision, confirmed by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, on Monday, 2nd of August, amounted to a shift by the administration, which had been working on plans to begin lifting the rule this summer, more than a year after it was imposed by the Trump administration. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, said allowing non-citizens to come over the border from either Mexico or Canada creates a serious danger of further spread of the coronavirus. President Joe Biden has come under intense pressure for months from some Democrats and supporters of more liberal immigration policies to lift the rule, which critics say has been employed less to protect public health than as a politically defensible way to limit immigration. The recent spread of the highly transmissible Delta variant of the coronavirus has bolstered the argument that the public health rule, known as Title 42, remains necessary to contain the coronavirus. And the virus's quickening spread comes as border officials are so overwhelmed with the persistent pace of illegal migration that they say that allowing more migrants into the country by lifting the rule poses the threat of a humanitarian crisis. Monday, 2nd of August, the American Civil Liberties Union said it would move forward with a lawsuit seeking to force the administration to lift the public health order for migrant families after months of negotiations with the ultimate goal of ending the policy, one of the group's lawyers confirmed. It is now clear that there is no immediate plan to do that. Lee Gallant of the American Civil Liberties Union, the lead lawyer of the case, said in a statement on Monday. The administration made repeated public statements that it just needed some time to build back the asylum system the Trump administration depleted. We gave them 7 months. That time is up. While the administration has used the rule to rapidly turn around single adults and many migrant families, it has not applied the restriction to migrant children arriving alone at the southern border, in a departure from the Trump administration. In a court filing on Monday, 2nd of August, responding to the American Civil Liberties Union's lawsuit, the administration said that blocking enforcement of the rule now would lead to the immigration system being further overwhelmed by asylum seekers and to even more overcrowded and unsafe conditions in border facilities. Overcrowding at the southern border stations makes it difficult to impose public health precautions like social distancing, the filing said, noting that more migrants have been testing positive for the coronavirus. More border officers are testing positive as well. Keeping the public health order in place, David Shahulian, the Assistant Secretary for Border and Immigration Policy at the Department of Homeland Security, said in the filing, is critical given the current conditions. President Biden campaigned on returning compassion to the country's immigration system and undoing the policies of his predecessor, Donald J. Trump, that significantly limited the number of asylum seekers the country would consider. That goal has proved difficult to achieve, leaving the White House under fire from the left for not moving aggressively enough to undo Donald Trump's legacy, even as Republicans accused Joe Biden of creating a crisis on the border, by suggesting that he will make it easier for many people to get a shot at entering the United States. President Biden has laid out a proposal for immigration law changes that includes a path to citizenship for some migrants already in the United States, but there is little hope of passing sweeping changes to the laws through bipartisan negotiation, so Democrats instead hope to use a budget-related legislative process to bypass Republican opposition. Over the weekend, the administration stepped up enforcement at the southern border, sending more officers to help border officials with lengthy processing necessary to bring migrants into the country and start making a case that they need asylum, the administration said in its court filing. To help relieve the backup, immigration officers are bringing more families to family detention centers, using the facilities as temporary shelters. The agency entered into a new contract to add more than 1,200 beds to its family housing capacity. The number of migrants crossing the southern border between the United States and Mexico exceeded the traditional seasonal spring surge in migration earlier this year, and the pace did not slow down with the arrival of the oppressive heat of the summer months. The number of times border officials caught migrants crossing illegally in June was the highest monthly figure since April of 2000. And the administration said preliminary figures for July indicate another new high. Just a few weeks ago, the administration was considering a plan to lift the public health rule for migrant families as early as the end of July, and later for single adults, who make up the bulk of the migrants who have been turned away since the beginning of the pandemic. Delaying those plans, possibly through to the end of the year, is sure to be welcomed by Republicans who have proposed legislation to maintain the rule for as long as necessary. But doing so also fuels Republican arguments that the southern border is in a state of crisis. Despite the public health rule, many migrant families have been allowed to enter the United States this year. The Biden administration has been able to enforce the rule in some areas of the border, but not others, such as southern Texas, in part because of a lack of shelter capacity in Mexico. and some migrant families have also been allowed to enter the country because of special exemptions, including migrants identified as vulnerable by advocacy groups and international organizations. But the varying degrees of enforcement of the public health rule have sown confusion among migrants and driven many to make repeated efforts at getting into the United States, despite pleas from the Biden White House not to. More than a third of the crossings tracked by Customs and Border Protection, CBP, in June were attempted by a repeat crosser. While the Border Patrol typically process migrants who cross the border illegally, the sheer number of people who have been crossing into Texas in the Rio Grande Valley, many of whom are Central American families fleeing violence and poverty, has led the administration to send police officers from Immigration and Customs Enforcement to assist with those duties and expand testing for the coronavirus. Two of the enforcement agencies' family detention centers are being used as expanded temporary shelters where families can stay until their processing is complete, a Biden administration official confirmed. Democrats were highly critical of Donald Trump's handling of a similar surge in 2019 when he proposed a regulation to indefinitely detain migrant families caught crossing the border illegally. The rule would have replaced a decades-old court agreement that requires a certain level of care for migrant children and a 20-day limit for how long they can be held in custody. In March, the Biden administration announced plans to hold migrant families for only 72 hours, a stark departure from the policies of both the Obama and the Trump administrations. Neither the Department of Homeland Security or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, responded to questions about the length of time the government planned to hold families in the detention centers turned temporary processing hubs so migrants are not waiting for days outside. We will be monitoring whether short-term processing and testing of families turns into longer-term detention, Mr. Gallant of the American Civil Liberties Union said.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.